Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. I'm coming in from outside and watching your conference for the last day makes me first want to tell you about all my medical insurance problems. And having four children and various grandchildren, I have plenty, even though I'm relatively well covered. However, I will spare you those stories. In talking about the current economic crisis, I'm also tempted to regale you with the outrages going on with the so-called bailout bill. I'll leave that, however, and focus on other things. I assume that you picked those up and are sufficiently outraged already. So let me leave that aside. I want to instead, first point out that really as soon as the voting machines were turned off a couple of weeks ago, the struggle began over how the Obama administration was going to handle social programs. For example, on Thursday morning, less than 48 hours after the election, on Thursday morning, the Boston Globe began a front-page story with the following theme, quote, President-elect Obama inherits a rapidly deteriorating economy that will likely dominate most of his first term, requiring massive federal spending to avoid a recession of historic scale, and constraining his ability to carry out his domestic agenda, analysts say. By the end of the week, The Economist came out with a similar story, taking the same line, and other pundits have picked up on the idea that we will have to forego social programs because of the economic crisis. Now, from a strictly economic perspective, reality is exactly the opposite. That is to say, dealing with this recession is going to require a massive stimulus program, and there is no better way to stimulate the economy than to pay for much needed social programs. So, in fact, the needs of the crisis and the need for social program work together. Now, of course, we all know that a single payer plan costs less, not more.
Amen.
But it gets tarred by the same "we can't afford it now" brush as do social programs in general. And one has to deal with the situation in that larger context. Now, in my message today, the message that I want to leave you with is that the struggle of those of us who want an effective health care program in the United States, that is to say, a single payer program, have in fact a lot going for us, in spite of these warnings about the need to clear off social programs. The current economic crisis provides an opening that we should take advantage of. Now, before I get to that message, however, I need to spend a little time talking about some aspects of the background of this crisis and how we got where we are. In doing that, I want to talk a little bit about income inequality, about power in the United States, and about the issue of regulation and deregulation. And then I'll be in a position to return to the specific ways that I think that the economic crisis creates an opening to push even harder for a single-payer plan. Now, before I talk about the background, however, I want to remind you just how bad the situation is. And you read the daily newspapers, if you don't experience it yourselves, about the foreclosures that last month it was up this much percent, and over the last year it was up that much percent. I haven't got the latest figures in my head, and likewise we know that a million jobs have been lost this year. And in the last 2 months alone, there were 500,000 jobs lost, and this month will mean the same sort of thing. But if you want to know really how bad it is, if you
want to know really how bad it is, you have to caught a story in a back section of yesterday's New York Times, which I can't help but read you just the beginning of. It says, feeling bad about how much you have been hurt by the stock market plunge? At least you don't have a lot of stock options. A survey of the paper losses suffered by the 175 chief executives of American companies shows that they lost a total of $52.3 billion through October 27th. To be sure, $15.9 billion, or nearly a third of the total, was lost by Warren Buffett alone. So when you see figures like that, you know there's something that is really going on differently.
Should we take up a collection?
When I'm through, I was going to pass the hat for Warren. I'll have reason to come back to Warren Buffett maybe later on. But underscoring how bad it is, let me tell you a little bit how I think we got here. And one of the factors that led us here, that created the framework in which we have this crisis, is the tremendous increase in inequality in the distribution of income that has occurred over the last 35 years or so in the United States. Now, I'm sure that you all have some awareness of this situation, but to underscore what has been going on, let me just present you with a few facts to remind you of the situation. In 1979, the average income of the top 5% of families was about 11 times as large as the average income of the bottom 20% of families. In 2005, that figure was 21%. It had almost doubled the gap between the top 5% and the bottom 20%. The CEO figures, I'm sure you've heard before, but let me remind you. In 1990, the top CEOs only earned 107 times as much as the average worker. Only. In 2005, they were obtaining 411 times as much on average. Between 1979 and 2004, American workers raised their productivity by 64%, while the median hourly compensation rose by 12%. In 1961, the minimum wage was $6.36 in terms of current buying power. Actually, in terms of 2005 buying power. In 2005, the national minimum wage was $5.15. Now, it's been raised since 2005, but in terms of 2005 buying power, still only $5.80. That is below the 1961 rate. Even when it goes up next July, it will probably still be below the 1961 level. These are all little bits of the story of what's happened to income distribution in this period. Now, but while we might all think that's bad, I certainly do. The question that I want to address is how does this relate to the crisis that we're in? And the way it relates to the crisis is that the inequality is what lies behind the tremendous growth in reliance on credit in our society. It lies behind this tremendous growth in credit in two ways. First of all, for individuals and families, in the context of a growing economy where their needs are growing, the only way people can meet their needs without their incomes going up, because most people's incomes aren't going up very much, the only way they can meet their needs is to take on more and more credit. So, on the one hand, it's driven by people's needs, individuals' needs, and families' needs. On the other hand, without people's incomes growing, there's a need to pump up demand to keep people buying things so the economy continues to grow and is stable. And that's exactly what the federal authorities have been doing system in order to maintain demand to keep the economy growing. Now, if you want to add a connection to this, you can connect it as well to the war in the Middle East. Because the war in the Middle East led to a doubling of oil prices. And that's not counting the oil spike we got, the price spike we got at the beginning of this year. Before that, it had already doubled since the beginning of the war. This put another $200 billion drain on the U.S. economy, making it even more necessary for the federal authorities to pump up demand through credit. Now, nowhere has this been clearer than in mortgage credit. If you go back to 1970, mortgage credit was, that is, what people owed on their mortgages, was 64% of after-tax personal income. That is, you take everybody's income, not company's income, but personal income, and mortgage obligations amounted to 64% of that. It then started sliding up. By 1990, it was 89%. It slid up a little more in the 90s to 94%. By 2006, mortgage debt had ballooned to 140% of after-tax personal income. Now, there's the housing bubble. That's the going out on a limb that we saw before things fell apart. Now, if I may digress for a moment about, while I'm still on the inequality issue, let me remind you of the direct connections between inequality and the issues that directly concern us here at this conference, that is, issues about health care. A recent report of the Congressional Budget Office showed not only that the life expectancy of the rich is greater than the life expectancy of the poor. I mean, that's no surprise. We all knew that. But that the discrepancy has been increasing. And this is what we might expect as the gap between the rich and the poor grows. Whereas in 1980, life expectancy at birth for the highest socioeconomic 10% was 2.8 years more than for the lowest 10%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is, I assure you. It is now more than 4.5%, or 4.5-year difference. But the big example of this comes from a study of Baltimore, where they compared neighborhoods. And when you compare the richest neighborhood in Baltimore to the poorest neighborhood in Baltimore, the lifespan difference is 20 years. In Roland Park, they live with an average 83. In the poor neighborhood, it's 60. Now, that's accounted for by a lot of things, one of which is health care access. Not only that, there are other things that account for it as well, but health care access is part of the issue. Finally, on this, well, on this digression, if you will, I should remind you that an unequal society is an unhealthy society, not only for the poor. It turns out that there are a lot of evidence that the whole society is affected negatively in its health outcomes by inequality. And you ask them, why? Well, that is, everybody is under the strain and the psychosocial problems that arise from always feeling either I'm going to fall down, and falling down in an unequal society is disastrous, especially when you go lose your health care, and somebody else always is above me. Apparently, there's a lot. There's various studies I hook into. I could spend all day talking about those. So that's another aspect of it. But let me return to the development of the crisis. We have this tremendous growth of inequality. Along with that, we have the growth of credit. Now, the other factor that is part of the rising inequality is that both cause and effect is a power shift in the United States. A power shift toward greater power for the wealthy and for large firms. As part of this power shift, they have been able to spread more and more widely what we come to call the free market ideology, the idea that whatever we do, the government should keep out of it as much as possible. that the government should not intervene in the economy. The government should not mess with the pharmaceuticals. It should not mess with the. It shouldn't put restraints on the auto companies. It shouldn't mess with the insurance companies, and certainly it shouldn't mess with the finance companies. A smaller and smaller role for government is what adds to the power of the people at the top and what they generated through that power. Now, in the context of the growing credit, how does this work? Well, let me give you some examples of the way it worked in the finance sector of the economy. What comes under the heading of deregulation, for example, is the elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was passed in the wake of the Great Depression in the 1930s that separated different financial institutions from one another. It separated commercial banks, particularly from investment banks, that is, the commercial banks that we all deal with, to the banks that handle the investments of large firms, that help them raise capital, that handle mergers, and so on. One of the reasons for this is that if these are all merged together, a crisis spreads more rapidly when problems develop. Well, that was eliminated in 1999. There are a lot of other things that came in the wake of the Great Depression, some of which, fortunately, have not been eliminated, like the FDIC. Think what we'd be today if we did not have the FDIC that has kept money in the banks to some degree. But in any case, the Glass-Steagall Act was sort of the symbol of the stability that was put on the financial system after the 1930s was gone. But there are other ways in which the government has kept out of regulation, one of which it hasn't enforced the regulations that exist. With regard to mortgages in particular, there was minimal, if any, oversight of the operation of mortgage companies in pushing loans on people. So there was, in fact, a lot of illegal activity that took place, a lot of actual lying to people, telling them one thing when the truth was different, getting them to take mortgages. There was also a lot of stuff that was outside the bounds of regulation that people wouldn't go to jail over this number. Now, the argument of the deregulators was, we don't have to regulate that, because nobody is stupid enough to go make a loan to somebody they know can't pay them back. I mean, we all know that. You don't make loans to people that can't pay you back. Well, something went wrong, because that's exactly what happened. And what went wrong has to do with another part of deregulation, that is, a failure to regulate new forms of financial activity. And the new form of financial activity has been, I make a mortgage, I loan you something, I got a piece of paper that says you owe me. I take that piece of paper, I put it in an envelope with other pieces of paper about you and you owning me, and I sell it to somebody else. So now all your payments flow to that person, and that's why they bought it. I'm out. If you don't make your payments, not my problem, I've got my money, I'm gone. So that's why I might make a loan to people that I don't know whether they can pay back or not, because it's not going to be my problem when they don't. Next step. Here I am now, I'm the person who's bought this package. And I say, well, I think this is good, everything's going up, but just to make sure, I'm going to buy an insurance policy that says, if this defaults, I get something from the insurance company. So I buy another piece of paper from the insurance company, and I pay them a premium each year. Now, insurance companies are regulated. They have to hold enough capital so that if your house burns down, if it's a fire insurance company, if your house burns down, they've got the money there. They don't have to hold everybody's money because all the houses don't burn down at once, but they've got to hold certain percentages. I guess if you're in Chicago, you still remember that sometimes the houses do all burn down once. But that's pretty unusual. But these insurance policies weren't called insurance policies. They were called credit default swaps. Who came up with the name? I have no idea. But they're insurance policies. But because they were called credit default swaps, the authorities looked the other way and didn't regulate them. Now, what's happened as the housing bubble has burst, and
In fact, these original packages of mortgages aren't being paid off. The people that are holding these insurance pieces of paper can't pay them because they got traded around. They became like bonds that were traded in the market. And nobody even knows how much there is or who holds it. And they don't have the money to pay. Banks, some Lehman Brothers had a whole lot of them. And it didn't have the money to pay off. But other banks hold it and nobody knows what they're worth, so banks won't loan to each other. Because if I don't know what you got, I'm not going to loan you any money. If I don't loan you any money, and nobody's loaning me any money, then if some individual comes to me outside the financial system or some company comes to me and they want money, I'm not making loans right now. That's what is meant by the credit system freezing up. And these pieces of paper floating around, those are what are called the poisonous or toxic assets. They're toxic because nobody knows what they are worth, and they're messing up, they're poisoning the whole system. Now, when you can't get these loans, then you have the rest of the economy turning sour, going down, because you need loans if you're in business for all sorts of everyday operations. So we've got this, the inequality and power inequality developing, the huge reliance on credit, and the lack of regulation, which are all tied together, leading in to this terrible mess that we find ourselves in today. Whether or not it will be bad for a year, 2 years, or three, don't believe it. If somebody tells you that they know one way or the other, I'm not saying it's going to be terrible. I don't know. I haven't got a crystal ball. But the point is that nobody else does either. That the people who are in the profession of making forecasts rely on mechanisms that are complex ways of drawing straight lines. But when something interrupts the straight line, they don't know. And we've got something new, as we have now. People don't know what's going to happen. I think there's some reason to be hopeful that this will turn around within a year or two. That this will not be as severe as the Great Depression. We could go there if you want. But it's very hard to tell. In the short run, certainly, in the next year, 18 months, 2 years, we're going to be dealing with this situation. And it's important for people in single-payer movement, or for that matter, in any other social program movement, to figure out how does this affect our work? What kind of opportunities does it create for us, and how does it affect the strategy? Well, there are some obvious things that I want to underscore for you. First of all, a crisis of this sort shows, if we need showing, the failure of the employer-based part of our healthcare system. As people lose their jobs, they not only lose their income, they of course lose their healthcare as well. Not only is this a severe problem, obvious problem in itself, but it places a strain on government finances because people are still going to try to get healthcare. And if they don't have insurance, they go to emergency rooms and other places. And that has to be paid for ultimately someplace. So it underscores that. There's also the fact that as firms move into failure or towards failure, they cancel their insurance coverage for their retirees. The biggest case so far has been GM. November 10th, the New York Times reported, quote, "To conserve its dwindling cash reserves, GM is eliminating lifetime health care coverage for its legions of retirees at the end of the year, leaving the former GM workers to fend for themselves." Now, we're going to see that continuing. This raises, of course, another issue that has always confused me a little bit, and that is why GM and other firms that are not directly connected to the insurance or pharmaceutical industry haven't been out there for a single-payer plan all along. When you think what it's costing them as opposed to their competitors elsewhere in the world, it's
hard to fail. But in any case, again, the healthcare burden, if you want to call it that, on firms has been an important issue, and it is made even more important in the current economic situation. So there are those things. Now, beyond those impacts, a single payer plan, this I alluded to earlier, a single payer plan would help us deal with the long run impacts of the current crisis on government spending. As a single payer plan comes into existence, it would yield a one-time drop. I don't mean it will all happen at once, but at some point we'll be able to look back and we'll be able to say all those costs associated with pushing paper are gone. It will yield that one-time drop. It will also yield a basis for saving over the long run. Now, this is terribly important if you are worried about the buildup of the national debt that will come from the deficit that the government's going to have to run in a big way if we are going to get out of this economic crisis in any reasonable amount of time. Now, as Peter Orszag, the director of the National Budget Office, noted in October, let me quote from him, says, many observers have noted that addressing the problems in financial markets and the risk to the economy may displace health care reform on the policy agenda. But although it may not seem immediately relevant given our current difficulties, it will be crucial to address the nation's looming fiscal deficit, which is driven primarily by rising health care costs as the economy recovers from this current downturn. Now, Orszag does not come out and support a single-payer plan, but certainly a single-payer plan is probably the only way to both reduce costs and maintain quality in the healthcare system. And that's really the thing, isn't it? For example, in Massachusetts, we have a much heralded new state program, and it can't make the costs. Now, one thing we can do as a state is abandon it. But that's politically, you know, after we've taken such credit for it, that's a little hard. So what do you do?
Money.
Reduce what you're getting from people at the bottom. You degrade the quality and save the money. Of course, you don't really save, you just change who pays and how they pay. They pay with their health, not just with their pocketbooks. But a single payer plan is the only way to meet what Orszag is talking about when he says getting health care costs under control is crucial for the long run national debt. And single payer, we should emphasize in that context, is the way to do it. But what seems to me as the most important opening that is created by the current crisis is that it discredits the ideology that I talked about earlier. It discredits the idea that free markets are the only way to go in finance. It's not just that it discredits it in finance, but it discredits it in general. When you go out and argue for a single payer, you hear people say, well, that's just more government involvement in the economy. And we all know that government involvement in the economy is bad. End of argument. Well, that's not the end of the argument anymore. That's not the end of the argument anymore. That particular position has been discredited. So discredited that Sarkozy, the president of France, who, remember, is the center-right, he's always described as the center-right in France, he's declared, quote, that laissez-faire capitalism is over. And he has railed against the dictatorship of the market. So when you've got Sarkozy saying that, now, France is different than the United States, we all know that. Nonetheless, I think he's being over-optimistic. I mean, it isn't dead. There are a few more nails to put in the coffin, to be sure. But you know that something is different as a result of the events of the last year or so. And we can take advantage of that. We have a different experience. What's happened in finance, for that matter, what's happening in Detroit with the automobile industries, thoroughly discredits the idea that the government shouldn't be involved. We can argue it now. Before, we couldn't even argue it. It was just dismissed. Now we have an opening argument. What's connected to that, what we learned in the last great crisis, which I hope this one does not equal, is that when a crisis takes place, that is a total disruption of the economy, there are opportunities for political change that did not exist before. In the 1930s, we saw that. We saw tremendous positive things. Now, remember, it could also be the other direction. Europe saw Nazism as a consequence, in part, of the Great Depression. Nothing's automatic in this situation. But it means there are possibilities for positive change that did not exist before. And we should certainly take advantage of that. Our problems are relatively clear. We've been talking about them for the last 24 hours or so. That we can be preempted by this Baucus bill. There's what Kennedy's going to do. And we even have an Obama problem, as excited as we all are. Let's not forget that on his website says Obama and Biden believe that we should avoid the two extremes. And what's one of those extremes? Government health care. So there's a problem here. I think that there's a problem that can be addressed. I think there's possibility for pushing. Seems that all of you think that as well. So now's the time to keep pushing. Thank you very much.